Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, October 19th, and we're going to finish up endocrine chapter, maybe move on to muscles today, not quite sure, but we got a couple items before we're going to start, and that is SI today, 1:30 to 3:30, room, humanities 203. Did that change, or is that the usual thing? That's the usual, so it's the usual time, usual room. Okay, good. And then I got a couple of announcements. The exam that is coming up is not this Thursday, but next Thursday. And let's see if I can figure out what chapters are going to be on there. Autonomic nervous system, yes, that's 9. Sensory physiology, 10. And endocrinology, 11. It looks like it's just going to be those three chapters. Because the another item that we have is that on Thursday of this week, we have a disaster drill scheduled for 10:30, and I know that's before this class because we don't meet until 11:30, but I don't know how long the disaster drill is going to take. All right, supposedly everybody in class at that time has to view a video or a movie on earthquakes or something, and then everybody's going to evacuate the building. And I don't know how long it will take to allow everybody back in the building. So hopefully everything will be done by 11:30, but I'm not sure. And if it's pouring outside like it is today, I don't know if they're going to evacuate or not. Again, I'm really not sure. So if we can't start right at 11:30, and if we can't start until maybe noon or 12:15 or 12:30, I would at least like to have a little bit of that time anyway to help get you ready for the exam. So even though class might be delayed because of the drill, we'll still have class for whatever period of time is left over. All right, so please come on in the building. All right, so disaster drill. Week 9 quiz, that the deadline usually is on Tuesdays at 11, all right, but it wasn't activated, so I activated it last night, so I'm extending the deadline for taking that quiz until Friday at 11, all right, so that gives you a couple extra days, but how long does a quiz take you to take? 6 minutes, good, 10 minutes, something like that, so... Right. Hopefully you've done the study in any way for it, and in 10 minutes you can wrap it up. All right, so any questions on when the test is, what's on the test, the schedule in the near term, that kind of stuff? No, we're all pretty good. Okay, any questions on endocrinology so far? Okay, so let's kind of finish up. We were talking about the pituitary, and we're almost done with the anterior pituitary. Remember that the pituitary gland... is really two glands that that are different from each other. The anterior is a lot different than the posterior pituitary. They secrete different kinds of hormones. The anterior pituitary is glandular tissue, but the posterior pituitary is really neuronal tissue, and it's an extension of the brain. All right, so let's finish up with the anterior pituitary. So you should know a list of hormones from the anterior pituitary. But we're kind of done talking about that. We're talking about control of the release of anterior pituitary hormones. And just like the posterior pituitary, it's controlled by the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain. So there are neurons in the hypothalamus when they become activated by other neuronal inputs, right? They integrate information up, and when a threshold is reached, they send an action potential down this axon. So these are tracks within the hypothalamus. And when it reaches the axon terminus here in the median eminence, then these axon terminals release a signaling compound that gets picked up by this first capillary bed, which then is transmitted exactly to the anterior pituitary via the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel right here. Remember, a portal vessel is a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back without having to go through the circulation or back to the heart. All right, so this is a special delivery system taking these signaling molecules directly to the anterior pituitary, and these signaling molecules could be excitatory, they could cause release of anterior pituitary hormones, or they could be inhibitory. All right, so we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. Most of the understanding for this class is just think of those signaling molecules as being excitatory, causing release of anterior pituitary hormones. Okay, now these signaling compounds that go through the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, what kind of signaling molecule do you think that is, if you had to characterize it? Would you call it a neurotransmitter, or would you call it a hormone? You would call it a neurohormone. That's right, because they're partly neurotransmitters because they're released by neurons, but they don't diffuse across the synapse, right? They are delivered by the circulatory system, so it has a component of both being a neurotransmitter and a hormone at the same time. So this shows the integration or the interaction between the nervous system and the endocrine system. You should really think of it as what? One system, the neuroendocrine system. Okay, that's for the anterior pituitary. So here we have a typical kind of response loop. We have two response loops that involve the hypothalamus, anterior pituitary, and then the target tissue in the body. There can be short feedback loops where the target tissue, for instance, like an ovary or testes, when it is releasing sex steroids into the blood, for instance, like estrogens and testosterone, which is a kind of androgen, right? That can have an effect on the anterior pituitary in a negative sense to decrease the amount of gonadotropins that the anterior pituitary releases. And remember, those gonadotropins are FSH and LH, which then maintains the proper levels of estrogen and testosterone in the blood. So this is what we would call a short feedback loop. But what controls the anterior pituitary? It is the hypothalamus, right? The hypothalamus controls the anterior pituitary. So these hormones, estrogen and androgens here, go back to the brain. Indeed, the blood carries them everywhere. And that can have a negative feedback loop on the hypothalamus, which then reduces the amount of gonadotropin-releasing hormone, right? That's the neurohormone that goes to the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract to the pituitary. That causes a decrease in FSH and LH, which then maintains estrogens and androgens at the proper level. So there are two kinds of feedback loops that can happen because of this multi-step regulation scheme involving the hypothalamus, anterior pituitary, and the target tissue. Now, some of these feedback loops can change from positive to negative, or from negative to positive feedback loops. One noteworthy example of that is when estrogen feeds back to the anterior pituitary, and instead of causing a decrease in LH hormone in the first part of the ovulatory cycle, it causes an increase, right? So it feeds back in a positive way. So as estrogen increases, right, that causes an increased level of luteinizing hormone from the anterior pituitary, which then causes an increase in estrogen, right, which then does what if it's a positive feedback loop on LH? It causes an increase in LH, right, which causes an increase in estrogen, and the follicle within the ovary matures, and when there is a peak in LH, that causes ovulation of a mature egg from a follicle, and then this feedback loop reverts to a negative feedback loop instead of being a positive feedback loop. So that surge in LH caused by positive feedback of estrogen to the anterior pituitary is what causes ovulation mid-cycle. So that's an interesting positive feedback mechanism, which is not a disease state, but that's a natural and normal occurring circumstance. All right, so since the hypothalamus is a part of the brain, it readily receives action potentials from other parts of the brain that we call higher centers, right? The higher centers of the brain can affect the pituitary, anterior pituitary secretion via the hypothalamus, so emotional states, psychological stress, various circadian rhythms can, probably different times of the year where photoperiod changes, right? Like now the days are getting shorter. It can affect things like maybe the menstrual cycle and adrenal hormones. So that makes perfect sense because our brain is supposed to be in communication with the environment and other things going around in our everyday life. So these things can affect, right, your endocrine system, which then affects other systems in your body. All right, so let's switch now to the posterior pituitary, which is, right, what kind of tissue is the posterior pituitary? More glandular or more nervous system? It's basically nervous system, right? So The posterior pituitary stores and releases two hormones, but these hormones are produced in the cell bodies of neurons that are located in the hypothalamus. And then they move by axonal transport to the axon terminus in the posterior pituitary. These two hormones are antidiuretic hormones. Sometimes it is called vasopressin, right? And you'll see why in just a second. Antidiuretic hormone, well, what does a diuretic do? Makes you lose water, right? So an antidiuretic would help you retain water. So that primary action is on the kidney. So antidiuretic hormone's action is to conserve water by the kidneys. The second action here, vasopressin, means that it's going to activate blood vessels to constrict. It's going to cause a constriction. All right, so both of those effects are going to have a powerful effect on blood pressure. Because, for instance, as your body retains water, what happens to your blood pressure? Think of your tire on your car. When you want to increase the pressure in the tire in your car, do you take air out or put air in? You put air in, right? So as we put fluid in your body, or as your body retains fluid, your blood pressure goes up because part of that fluid ends up in the circulatory system. All right, another example would be when you have a water balloon and you squeeze down on that water balloon, analogous to blood vessels constricting, what happens to pressure in that water balloon? Does it go up or down or stay the same? It goes up. When you change the volume, decrease the volume, the pressure goes up. They are inversely related to each other. So both of these effects, water conservation and vasoconstriction, increase blood pressure. So this posterior pituitary is involved in regulating blood pressure because of those two effects. The second hormone, oxytocin, is excitatory on smooth muscle, particularly the uterus, all right? And that's an important hormone that is involved in parturition, right? When the fetus is at term for delivery. But oxytocin is also important because it contracts smooth muscle of that line glandular tissue and ducts of glandular tissue in the mammary gland, and it's responsible for the milk letdown reflex, or sometimes we call it the milk ejection reflex that happens. All right, so oxytocin works with prolactin. Prolactin is necessary for the development of the breast. Oxytocin is necessary for ejection of milk from the breast. So both of those are important. Okay, so here we see the posterior pituitary. Now these hormones, oxytocin and ADH, are not released by the hypothalamus, but they are produced there, right? So the supraoptic nucleus right here produces ADH, and the paraventricular nucleus makes oxytocin. And when we say nucleus, what the heck does that mean? Cell bodies, right? Dendrites and nerve cell bodies of these axons right here. There's a group of them, tens of thousands of them, and it just gives this area the appearance of what? A gray kind of color, because they are not myelinated. So when they receive input from many other neurons that come to the hypothalamus, right? And if it reaches threshold, then an action potential moves down this axon. And what do we call a group of myelinated axons in the central nervous system? A tract. So here we have the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. It's not a portal system because that's a blood vessel. And that action potential reaches this axon terminus. And these synaptic vesicles right here, some of them contain ADH, others contain oxytocin, depending on what nucleus they originated from. And when that action potential reaches the axon terminus, then those signaling compounds are released into the interstitial space, and they're picked up by capillaries. And from anatomy, why is it possible for these signaling molecules, ADH and oxytocin, to enter the circulation right here via this capillary? What's special about capillaries? They're specialized for exchange because the structure is what? They only have one very thin, they only have a simple squamous endothelium, and it's highly permeable, so these molecules can diffuse right into the circulatory system, and then they're carried everywhere in the body where they have target tissues, if those target tissues, of course, have a particular receptor. Or that's basically the definition of a target tissue. It has to have a receptor that matches up in shape to these signaling compounds. Now, what would you call ADH and oxytocin? Are those hormones, Or are those neurotransmitters? They're neurohormones, right, because they're being released by these neurons, but their mode of action is more like a hormone, so it's a combination of both of those. And again, that shows a nice interface between the nervous system and endocrine system, how it functions together really as one system, the neuroendocrine system. All right, so make sure you know what the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract is and the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. And hypothalamus is not too hard to understand what that means, but hypophysis, what structure are we talking about when I say hypophysis, if somebody uses that term? What is that in anatomy? Hypophysis is just another name for the pituitary gland. Okay, so hypophysis is pituitary gland. So that's how they named these tracts and that portal vessel right there. Okay, so we're done with the hypophysis and ready to move on to another endocrine gland, which is the adrenal gland. All right, so the adrenal gland is just superior to the kidneys, kind of like a hat right on top of the kidney right here. It consists of two major regions with some subregions within the two major regions, and the two major regions is one superficial right here, which we call the what is a superficial region of any organ? Cortex. The cortex, right? So here's the adrenal cortex, and then the deeper region, the adrenal medulla. And again, this is kind of like the pituitary gland. Embryologically speaking, they originate from two different layers, right? So, but they combine together to form one gland. But they're controlled differently, and they secrete different kinds of hormones. All right, so on the histology slide we see over here, the cortex has three subzones, the glomerulosa, which is superficial, and fasciculata and reticularis, which is a little bit deeper, but the adrenal medulla, you could consider that just one layer, and these cells right here are chromaffin cells. The chromaffin cells are really like a postganglionic sympathetic neuron. All right, so what the heck is a postganglionic sympathetic neuron? Any kind of autonomic pathway has how many neurons going from the central nervous system to the effector organ? Has two, right? The preganglionic and the postganglionic. This system is, and this is a good review for your autonomic nervous system, right? These chromaffin cells are really like the postganglionic neuron in a regular sympathetic outflow pathway, except that they're really not neurons. They don't carry action potentials anywhere. But when they receive acetylcholine, because they contain nicotinic receptors, right, when they are stimulated by acetylcholine from the preganglionic sympathetic fiber, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the blood because there are capillaries in the adrenal medulla. All right, so these chromaffin cells act like the postganglionic cells. All right, so and the medulla then synthesizes and secretes 80% epinephrine and 20% norepinephrine. This goes into the blood. All right, so those chromaffin cells or these compounds right here, usually we consider norepinephrine a neurotransmitter, but in this particular case, because they end up in the circulatory system, you should consider these what? Neurohormones, right? Neurohormones. So again, that illustrates the interface between the endocrine system and nervous system. Think of it what? As more like the neuroendocrine system. Okay, as far as the cortex is concerned, we have three main classes of hormones that are released, and one is cortisol. Cortisol is a glucocorticoid because it has its major effect on glucose metabolism in the body. So cortisol inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis, right? So it preserves glucose. And it promotes the synthesis of new glucose, right? The reverse of glycolysis. So cortisol, what do you think cortisol has an effect on blood glucose? Does it go up or down? It goes up, right? Because it causes the synthesis of new glucose and it helps prevent utilization of glucose, right? So blood glucose goes up and especially adipose tissue then takes up a lot of glucose because it's high in the blood and adipose cells proliferate as a result of that. Another hormone is aldosterone. And aldosterone has one primary effect on the kidneys to resorb sodium. and secrete potassium in urine. All right, so aldosterone has a way of affecting what is secreted in the urine. Namely, it helps preserve sodium in the body, but it helps with the loss of potassium. And since it affects these minerals right here, aldosterone is what we call a mineralocorticoid. Cortisol, on the other hand, is what? A glucocorticoid. So the cortex secretes glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids. Here are two specific examples. And here is a little trick to help remember what the effect of aldosterone is in the body. Notice that the effect on sodium and potassium are what? Are they the same or opposite? They're opposite each other. Okay? So if on a board exam, right, you see what hormone causes the reabsorption of sodium but the secretion of potassium, if you ever see a hormone having an opposite effect of sodium and potassium, you immediately, even if you can't remember the exact mechanism of action, you should just say what? Aldosterone, right? So that's a nice key to remember. Opposite effects on sodium and potassium. And when we get to the renal chapter, the kidney chapter, we'll see exactly why that happens. But maybe just for now, just you have to memorize that. Okay, and then the third class of hormones that are secreted by the adrenal cortex are sex steroids, in particular androgens, male sex hormones. All right, and it doesn't matter if it's a male adrenal cortex or female adrenal cortex, right, they both secrete androgens. And that's necessary for, well, supporting sexual behavior, basically. Okay? All right, so here we have the adrenal cortex. It's broken down into its couple zones, the glomerulosa, which is the superficial one, and then the deeper ones, the fasciculata and reticularis. The glomerulosa is important for synthesizing and releasing mineralocorticoids, which have an effect on what kind of metabolites in your body. And as a matter of fact, you almost don't consider these metabolites. You want to consider them electrolytes, right? So what electrolytes does do mineralocorticoids adjust in your body? Okay. The electrolytes are sodium and potassium. Okay. While glucocorticoids affect what? Metabolism of glucose. And that's done by the fasciculata and reticularis. And on this slide, what I want you to appreciate is, what is the precursor molecule? It is cholesterol, right? So cholesterol is problematic for some people. If it's too high, it causes cardiovascular disease, but you have to have normal levels in your body to produce these various steroid hormones. So it's very important. You can't live without cholesterol. It's also an important structural component of plasma membranes as well, right? It helps stabilize plasma membranes. All right, so through various metabolic pathways, you don't have to know any of these pathways right here. You have to know maybe the different zones of the kidney and the precursor molecule, and the glomerulosa produces mineralocorticoids, and the fasciculata and reticularis, again, starting with cholesterol, produce various glucocorticoids like corticosterone and cortisol, but some of these intermediates can also produce androgens. Right, and that's in the reticularis and fasciculata, starting with cholesterol again. So all of these compounds are related to each other, right? And there's just very simple modifications between corticosterone and cortisol and androgens. But I suppose that shouldn't be much of a surprise to you, because what is one of the characteristics that receptors exhibit? They exhibit high specificity, right? Small changes in the structure of these signaling compounds cause major changes in how they bind to various receptors, because receptors show a high degree of specificity. The shape has to be just right in order for binding to occur. Okay, so that's another kind of important point about this slide. All right, so the hormonal effects of epinephrine last about 10 times longer than norepinephrine, right? It's not degraded as fast as norepinephrine is. And we're looking at the adrenal medulla now. The adrenal medulla is innervated by the preganglionic sympathetic fibers, which release acetylcholine, and then the chromaffin cells depolarize, releasing norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. And that is what produces, one of the things that produces the fight or flight response. Remember, one of the characteristics of the sympathetic nervous system is a high degree of divergence of signals in the body. So when the sympathetic nervous system gets stimulated, it causes an increase in sympathetic tone all over the body because of divergence of the nervous system, but also the release of epinephrine and norepinephrine in the blood, because where does it go once it's in the blood? Everywhere in the body. So that stimulates sympathetic receptors all over the body. So it causes an increase in respiratory rate, causing hyperventilation, increase in heart rate, but also force of contraction, which is going to cause the heart to pump more blood, and so cardiac output goes up. We'll see how heart rate and cardiac output are related in the next couple chapters coming up. Sympathetic stimulation also causes vasoconstriction in many parts of the body, which then causes more blood to go back to the heart, which also increases cardiac output. You'll see how that happens in the next couple chapters. But vasoconstriction also has an effect on blood pressure in the sense of what? Does it increase blood pressure when there's vasoconstriction or decrease blood pressure? Increases, just think of that water balloon once again. And increased sympathetic tone causes glycogenolysis and lipolysis, which has what effect on blood glucose levels? It increases blood glucose levels, right? When you start to break down glycogen, you break it down into glucose, right? And the liver has the ability to secrete that glucose because, right, it has a glucose-6-phosphatase, which can take the phosphate off, and then glucose is free to diffuse into the blood. So we see that many hormonal mechanisms and sympathetic activity of the autonomic nervous system, they all have what kind of effect on blood glucose? Decrease or increase? Increasing blood glucose, so it's probably no big surprise that many people have trouble regulating blood glucose levels. It's always on the high side because most of your body is geared to deal with stress, right, which boosts blood glucose, which produces a form of diabetes mellitus. All right, so you're probably wondering, how on earth do any of us ever regulate blood glucose? And so we're going to have to eventually look at the pancreas in this chapter and see that there are two hormones that work antagonistically to each other, right, to help maintain blood glucose in the proper range. Okay, but we're not going to talk about pancreas. That's the last organ we're going to talk about. So let's go to thyroid gland. Unless you want me to, let's do thyroid gland first. Okay, thyroid gland. All right, it's just underneath the thyroid cartilage and the cricoid cartilage of the larynx. All right, just kind of surrounds the trachea a little bit. It secretes our hormone T3 and T4, triiodothreonine and tetraiodothreonine, and these go in the blood. These hormones are necessary to regulate growth during development and even as an adult for repair, right, because you need mitosis taking place, not as much as during development, but you still need to replace old and damaged tissues, but it also helps the base. It also sets the basic metabolic rate of all tissues in the body. So that's a very important function. The thyroid gland consists of follicles, and follicles are just microscopic spherical structures. We're going to see that the ovary has follicles, so it's not like a hair follicle, for instance. It's just a little sphere where certain things happen. And the outer layer is composed of cells that synthesize tetraiodothreonine, and then it's secreted into the inner part of a follicle, and an inner part of any kind of follicle is filled with a fluid-like material, which is also rich in proteins. So here is a nice illustration of just a follicle, a microscopic structure inside the thyroid gland, and a follicle can actively transport iodide, right, which is the ionic form of iodine, into the colloid right here, or the space inside the follicle, and then that iodide is oxidized into iodine, right, so there's an enzyme that converts it into iodine, and then it's combined with thyroglobulin, which then makes tyrosine or diiodotyrosine. So these have either one or two molecules of iodine bound to it, and then the mono and di can combine together to form a triiodothreonine or maybe two of these iota tyrosines can combine to form this the tetraform, the tetraiodothreonine. And then these hormones, T3 and T4, are bound to thyroglobulin, and they are stored within the follicle of the thyroid gland. All right, so this metabolic process, including the uptake of iodine right here and the production of T3 and T4, is controlled by a hormone from the anterior pituitary, which is thyroid-stimulating hormone. So the anterior pituitary controls the metabolism of the thyroid gland via what? Thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary. So when thyroid-stimulating hormone increases, that causes the production of a lot of T3 and T4, but also the secretion of T3 and T4 into the blood. And maybe some of you are wondering, well, when it's in the blood, why is it carried by the blood? Because T3 and T4 are hydrophobic compounds, right? And blood is mostly made out of plasma, and plasma is mostly made out of water, right? So there has to be like a detergent kind of molecule that acts as an interface between the water environment and the lipophilic environment that T3 and T4 want to be in, right? And so that's what we call the protein plasma carrier molecule. So this protein right here has hydrophilic regions and hydrophobic regions and can allow T3 and T4 to dissolve in plasma, which then is carried throughout the whole body. All right, so this process is really dependent on thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary. But in order to have an effective T3 and T4 hormone, which is going to affect what, growth and development as well as basal metabolic rate, there is a compound that you need to have in your diet because you can't produce this compound on your own. It's just an element. It was one of the elements that you had to memorize on the periodic table, and that was iodine, right, in the form of iodide. So if you don't have iodide in your diet, let's look at the effect of your physiology and also this regulatory mechanism right here. All right, so we said the anterior pituitary releases thyroid-stimulating hormone that goes to the thyroid gland that stimulates the thyroid gland to produce T3 and T4, and there's a nice negative feedback loop right here, which shows that when T3 and T4 are at the proper levels, it feeds back negatively to do what to the TSH levels secreted by the anterior pituitary. It will reduce the levels of TSH, right, so that too much T3 and T4 is not in the blood. Okay. And the anterior pituitary not only is controlled by this nice negative feedback loop, but it is also controlled by the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus releases thyroid releasing hormone, right, or releasing factor. This is the neurohormone released by the hypothalamus. How does it get into the anterior pituitary? Just kind of as a review. Via the portal blood vessel, that's right. Portal blood vessel goes to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary releases TSH, which goes to the thyroid gland, causing release and production of T3 and T4. And if there's proper levels of iodide in your diet, then because of the negative feedback mechanisms, you can maintain the proper levels of T3 and T4 in the blood. You can have proper development and proper basal metabolic rate in your body. But what happens if there's inadequate iodide in your diet? Well, then your body cannot make T3 and T4, right? It has maybe the amino acids to make something that you might consider a pre-hormone, right, but not an active hormone. So you have low levels of T3 and T4. All right, so then let's think of the feedback loop, right? Because then T3 and T4 go to the anterior pituitary is going to say, oh, you have really low levels of T3 and T4 in your body, way below the set point. What is the anterior pituitary going to do? It's going to release excess thyroid stimulating hormone, that's going to go to the thyroid gland, and the thyroid gland will recognize that signal because it has receptors, so it's going to hypertrophy, it's going to grow, and it's going to try to catch up and make proper levels of T3 and T4, right? So there's more cells, the factory gets bigger, but can it make T3 and T4? No, because there's no iodine in the diet. So it's going to continue to hypertrophy and get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Even though it can't produce an adequate T3 and T4 because there's no iodine. And that condition, when somebody's thyroid gland gets big, that's called goiter. And it's rare to see anybody with goiter in the United States because it's fairly easily diagnosed because it's this huge mass on their neck, right? And it's hard not to have proper iodine in your diet because all of our salt products are enhanced with iodine. Okay? Huh? Most, not all, but you can go to a health food store or shop in certain places in the supermarket and get salt that is not laced with iodine. But if you have a normal diet, usually with a normal diet, you have normal iodine levels as well. Okay. But because of global travel, okay, you see people from all over the world, and maybe if you're at LAX or something, somebody getting off an airplane, you might actually find somebody if you look around with goiter getting off of an airplane, but it's kind of a rare pathology to actually see. Okay, and that might be one reason why the thyroid gland might be big, all right, because of not proper iodide in the diet. But another reason is what the thyroid gland might be cancerous, right? It might be a tumor. And of course, that's why we need healthcare professionals like you guys to what, come up with a diagnosis. What's the problem? Okay, so iodine won't cure cancer of the thyroid gland. It will just cure what, goiter. Yeah. Oh, I can't quite hear you. Say it again. Sure. Yeah, it can go back to normal. Yeah, yeah. So it's a pretty nice simple treatment. All right, so that's the thyroid gland. Involved with the thyroid gland, there is something called the parathyroid glands. All right, and the parathyroids, and this is handy, release parathyroid hormone. Okay, and parathyroid hormone is stimulated by a decrease in blood calcium levels. Now, what is blood calcium good for? Well, you need it to make strong bones, but you need it for synaptic transmission, right? Calcium is used as a second messenger in many cells in the body, including the endocrine system, and we'll see for muscles. It's an important compound in muscles that cause muscle contraction, right? So calcium is much more important than just for bones. You have to have the proper level in your blood. All right, and when blood levels decrease, it can be increased by parathyroid hormone because parathyroid hormone acts on bones. It demineralizes bones to release calcium into the blood, but it also causes the kidneys to resorb calcium from the filtrate so you don't lose it in urine. So here, I can't remember if this is an exam figure or not, but it's a really good one if it is, right? So if the stimulus is decreasing blood calcium levels, the parathyroid glands will monitor that and will release parathyroid hormone, which then goes to the kidney that causes resorption of calcium. What resorption means is that it will take it from a fluid that will eventually become urine and put it back in the blood, so you have increased blood calcium levels, right? That decreases urinary excretion of calcium, but parathyroid hormone also causes the demineralization of bone, increasing blood calcium. So this is what, a nice negative feedback mechanism, because increased blood calcium level is what? Does it add to or subtract from the initial stimulus? It subtracts from the initial stimulus of decreasing blood calcium. So that helps maintain blood calcium at the proper level. Okay, so that's the thyroid gland. So now we can get to the pancreas. The pancreas is kind of tucked a little bit posterior and inferior to the stomach. And here's the head of the pancreas and the tail of the pancreas. And the pancreas, maybe from anatomy you remember, has an exocrine function as well as an endocrine function, because I see a duct right here. All right, the duct is related to what kind of function, the exocrine or endocrine function? Exocrine, because the pancreas produces prehormones for digestion that then are secreted into the duct, and the duct, pancreatic duct, takes it to the duodenum where they're activated. All right, but there's also an endocrine, an important endocrine function. of the pancreas outside of the cells for the exocrine function. And the endocrine cells are located in little islands that we call the islets of Langerhans. All right, so Langerhans was a scientist that was observing the pancreas. Okay, and they're just kind of scattered all around in the pancreas. And there are two kinds of cells, which maybe you can see on this slide right here. Maybe they have a little bit different color. There's alpha cells and beta cells, right? You can call them cell 1 and cell 2 if you wanted to. And they secrete different hormones. One secretes insulin, and the other secretes an antagonist to insulin, namely glucagon. All right, so that should be really heartening to you. Right, nice antagonistic control of blood glucose levels. So the alpha secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. All right, so what glucagon does, or the effect of glucagon on blood glucose, is to raise it. Okay, and then from that you should be able to realize then that insulin's effect on blood glucose is to lower it. Right, so they have antagonistic effects. So how glucagon works is that it stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis, which increases blood glucose as a result. So there are glucose receptors in the alpha cells and the beta cells, right? And then they will release their hormones in proper response to blood glucose levels, right? The betas secrete insulin when blood glucose is high. That promotes the entry of glucose into most cells, like, for instance, muscle cells. Not the brain. The brain has GLUT1 transporters. It's always able to import glucose, which you probably realize is really important because glucose is necessary for glycolysis to make ATP. All right, so how does insulin work? Kind of just as a review, how does it promote entry of glucose? What does it do in a really short way? How would you talk about that? How does insulin work as a passport for most cells to import glucose? What happens to the plasma membrane when insulin is there? Insulin binds to a tyrosine kinase receptor, which then causes the fusion of endosomes to the plasma membrane, and part of the endosome membrane are the GLUT4 transporters, which allow glucose to diffuse across the plasma membrane. So those GLUT4 transporters just allow for facilitated diffusion of glucose from high concentration outside the cell. Right, when blood glucose is what? High into the cell, so that takes glucose up from the blood, and then when these cells take up glucose because of those GLUT4 transporters, then of course blood glucose levels decrease as a result of that. So when glucose enters cells, then that stimulates the conversion of glucose into glycogen and also into fat as a result, and that decreases blood glucose. So here is a nice flow diagram that shows a stimulus, an increase in blood glucose. All right, that's going to go to the pancreas. And what cells are going to be stimulated by high blood glucose? Is it going to be the alpha or beta cells? The beta cells, because the beta cells release insulin, which becomes stimulated when glucose is high. So insulin is secreted, and that travels everywhere in the body, binds to those tyrosine kinase receptors on cells. The GLUT4 transporters are put in the plasma membrane. These cells take up glucose, right? And when cells take up glucose, for instance, in the liver, then glucose can be converted to glycogen. And adipocytes love to convert glucose into triglycerides. And when cells take up glucose, that lowers blood glucose levels. So this is the response, decrease in blood glucose. How does it relate to the initial stimulus? Yeah, it subtracts from it, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. And I don't know if I have another slide after that. I don't. So let's think of a different possibility right here. Let's modify this slide, and let's just say instead of an increase in blood glucose, there's a decrease in blood glucose. All right, that is monitored by the cells of the islets of the pancreas, but in particular, which cells? The alpha cells. The alpha cells will respond by increasing the release of glucagon. The beta cells, on the other hand, will decrease the amount of insulin that they secrete. Right? But let's go back to the alpha cells. They'll increase levels of glucagon. And what's going to happen here? Glucagon is going to stimulate the reverse of this process right here. What do we call the reverse of glycogen to glucose? Glycogenolysis. Yeah, glycogenolysis. You always have to think, make sure I'm saying it right. Right. So in the liver, there will glucagon will stimulate glycogenolysis. It will stimulate lipolysis, so it will increase glucose. Right. So you have an increase in blood glucose, and so that would subtract from the initial stimulus, which was a decrease. And so, right, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So this nice antagonistic mechanism between the alpha cells and beta cells, or between insulin and glucagon, usually provide for precise control and balance of glucose in your blood, and that maintains really nice nervous system function, because the nervous system doesn't have those GLUT4 transporters. It just has a GLUT1 kind of transporter, which is always active. It's never taken out of the plasma membranes of neurons. Okay. So that's it for endocrine system. So that's the last material that you're responsible for on the test. Okay? So that's that. Any questions? Yes.
Can you
explain pro-hormones and pre-hormones? Yep. Think of maybe a good model to think of is, for instance, think of the exocrine function of the pancreas right here, all right, which is what? Going to produce enzymes, digestive enzymes. And in that particular case, when the pancreas produces digestive enzymes, the pancreas has to be a little tricky and concerned, because when it makes the digestive enzymes, those digestive enzymes could digest the pancreas itself, right? So they're produced in an inactive form and then transported to the duodenum right here, where they become activated. So that protects the pancreas from autodigestion. That's the exocrine function. So hormones are made kind of in the similar kind of thought pattern in the body. So they're first produced in an inactive form, so that they are not released into the circulatory system until they are needed and ready to go to work. All right, so they're produced and held in a reservoir, like in the form of a pre-hormone or a pro-hormone. Right, and when the necessity arises, they can be converted very quickly into an active form. All right, because in order to make a hormone, it might take a number of hours, or maybe half a day to make a hormone, and it might take a day to raise it up to the proper level in the body. But if there's a reservoir of inactive hormones that can be converted very quickly into an active form, then when it's needed in the body, it can have an immediate effect. And the other thing is, too, then that particular tissue that's producing that hormone isn't overstimulated by the effects of that particular hormone, just like the effects of digestive enzymes in the pancreas is really dangerous, right? When you have pancreatitis, those digestive enzymes become activated in the pancreas, or when you have pancreatic cancer, they become activated in the pancreas, and that just hastens the demise of the pancreas. So it's important to make precursor signaling compounds so that you have a reservoir that can be activated very quickly, but it also prevents their overstimulation of a tissue that produces them. So those two reasons right there. Okay. What about any other kinds of questions on endocrine systems? So know the definition of a hormone or an endocrine gland. Yeah. Priming effects. Yes. Sometimes, for instance, we saw with nuclear hormone receptors, right? It requires not just one hormone, but two hormones to initiate transcription. So because a nuclear hormone response unit has two binding sites, sometimes it needs to bind hormone receptors that are exactly the same. We would call that a homodimer. Sometimes it needs to bind two different hormones that would produce then that heterodimer, and the priming effect would be that you have to have one hormone before the second hormone can have an action, because you need both of those to initiate transcription. You need to have both hormones in order to initiate transcription. And there's also an interaction between epinephrine. Another example might be an interaction between cortisol and epinephrine. Both in many systems in the body, you need to have both epinephrine and cortisol to affect the release of glucose from the liver. So epinephrine would be like a priming effect. It has to be present before cortisol can have an effect on the liver. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah. If you have any questions at the end of the chapter, which I can't remember if you do, or if you have any online questions, okay, then yes. Yeah. And there might be a couple in there. Okay. All right, so let's move to something that you guys are really all experts in. Maybe not quite so confusing as some of these other things. So something you might be a little bit more familiar with, and that is muscle physiology. Because you guys have studied muscles a lot in anatomy. Okay, so some of these things I'm going to go over pretty quickly because it's just kind of a review. Here's a nice illustration from anatomy, but it's a basis of our understanding of physiology, so I want to go over it, but just really, really quickly. Right, so here we got a bone, right? Here we got a muscle. And here we got a connection between a muscle and a bone, and that's what you call a? Okay, that's what we call a tendon. Okay, that's just dense, regular connective tissue, right? That's just a tendon right here, muscle-to-bone connection. And that tendon is continuous with the connective tissue that surrounds this whole muscle, for instance, like the coracobrachialis or the biceps, right? And sometimes we call that the muscle belly because it looks like a stomach kind of just hanging there in your body. And within the muscle, we see that it is arranged in groups, and these groups we call fascicles. All right, so a whole muscle, the building block of a whole muscle right here are these fascicles. All right, and what's the building block of a fascicle? We see that here is a fascicle is composed of many, many cells, and the same thing, or what a cell is really a fiber, because a skeletal muscle cell is long and narrow. It was at one time thousands of cells that fused together into one long rod that we call a fiber. All right, so the building block of a muscle are fascicles. The building block of fascicles are cells, and they have different connective tissue sheaths around them. All right, so the connective tissue sheath around every fascicle is called the perimysium, and the connective tissue around every muscle, right, is the epimysium, and the connective tissue sheath around every muscle cell or fiber is the endomysium, and these things all fuse together, right, to form a tendon that then fuses into this muscle right here, so that when these muscles contract, because that's what a muscle is specialized to do, right, is to contract, all these different connective tissue sheaths pull on each other and pull on the tendon and eventually pull on this bone, and then it causes the bone to move. Right, at least one end of the muscle. What end of the muscle moves the most? The insertion, very good. The origin is more stationary end of the muscle, that would be the opposite one, right? And so one end of the muscle moves more than the other end. Okay, so know that hierarchical organization. Furthermore, we can break down a muscle cell into some components as well. Okay? So here we have a muscle cell, and we see some kind of repeated pattern over and over and over again inside this cell, because there are tubes inside of this muscle cell or muscle fiber, and these tubes right here are what we call myofibrils. Okay. And so each one of these are myofibrils right here, and a myofibril is really the organelle for contraction. So every muscle fiber has many, many myofibrils. You could think of them as like mitochondria, except that they're what? Really long and narrow, and they have a different structure on the inside. They don't have the Christi membrane and all that kind of stuff. They have a different kind of structure. So you can break a myofibril down into its various components that are myofilaments. All right, so I want you to be able to go up and down in this level of organization. If we put a bunch of myofibrils together, if we put a bunch of myofilaments together, we get a myofibril, which is the organelle of contraction. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a muscle fiber. All right, it is confusing. And if we put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get a muscle. Right? And don't forget, there's connective tissue, different kinds of connective tissue between these different levels that all connect together as it moves up into the tendon so that they all pull together on this particular bone. Okay, and these myofilaments are arranged in such a way so that myofibrils have this repeating pattern in it. And as a matter of fact, that repeating pattern is the same even in neighboring myofibrils. And we're going to see that that repeating pattern is even the same in neighboring muscle fibers. And so when you look at a muscle underneath a microscope, you don't see just a blur of light and dark bands. All these light and dark bands just line up exactly on top of each other. So that's what gives skeletal muscle its what striated appearance. All right, so that's a characteristic of skeletal muscle. And one kind of involuntary muscle as well, which is what kind of muscle am I thinking about? Cardiac muscle is striated as well. All right, some other definitions. The cell membrane around a muscle fiber is called the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear that word sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle cell. Okay. And a skeletal muscle cell has many nuclei in it, could have thousands of nuclei because at one time this one muscle cell was 1,000 different individual precursor muscle cells that fused together. Okay, so here just shows the striations. All right, so a muscle cell is kind of interesting. What makes a muscle cell noteworthy? What's a noteworthy? That was strange. Did it just turn off?
Yeah.
So it got louder and then turned off. Okay. I guess it probably ran out of batteries and it came back. I can hear it now. Okay, bad connection someplace. Okay, so what's noteworthy about skeletal muscle? It's the only kind of tissue in your body that what? Yeah, it's the only thing that you have voluntary control of in your entire body. So that's really noteworthy. Right? And how is skeletal muscle controlled? It's controlled by somatic motor neurons. So here is a somatic motor neuron, right? And these action potentials originate in what part of the brain? Can you remember what part of the brain that these action potentials originate in? The frontal lobe, that's the motor cortex, like the precentral gyrus, that's your primary motor cortex. And then it sends signals down the spinal cord, interacts with the cerebellum, of course, because that controls motor activity, interacts with the basal nuclei in the brain, because that's what inhibits some motor activity so that your motor function is nice and smooth and easily controlled. But eventually we have action potentials coming down this motor neuron, and remember it only takes one to go from the central nervous system to this skeletal muscle right here. And here is a synapse. What the heck is a synapse? It's the structural and functional unit of communication between two cells, but this is kind of a special synapse. It's different than a neuron-neuron synapse because when this muscle cell gets excited, guess what it wants to do? Yeah, it's going to move. It's going to jump around. It's going to want to pull away from this axon terminus right here. So that's one difference between this synapse and a neuron-neuron synapse. Right, so there are special structures that make sure that this axon terminus is glued in place right over this muscle cell. All right, and so the structure is a little bit different, so we don't really call it a synapse. We call it a neuromuscular junction. All right, so here is a neuromuscular junction, but nonetheless it has some similarities. It has synaptic vesicles, right, in the axon terminus. It's loaded with mitochondria because it's a very active process. And these synaptic vesicles right here contain acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, right, which is released due to calcium influx, and that acetylcholine diffuses across the neuromuscular cleft, or you could call that neuromuscular junction right here, and it will bind to nicotinic type acetylcholine receptors. And what can you tell me about a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor? Okay, it's just a sodium channel that opens up, which then does what to this muscle cell right here? It depolarizes it, right? So sodium is going to enter the cell. Positive charges are going to cause depolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, so that just produces that typical kind of EPSP that you're familiar with neurons, right? And that's really the only thing that happens with skeletal muscle. There is nothing that can inhibit this sarcolemma right here. So innervation of skeletal muscle only produces EPSPs. Nothing can ever produce an IPSP, right? Because when you send action potentials to a muscle, it's not going to make a decision on what to do. What is it automatically going to do is contract, right? Because it's obeying your conscious thought. Okay. And because of that, muscle cells are a little bit different. So not only are there nicotinic receptors right here that cause depolarization, in the neuromuscular junction, oh, I tell you what kind of channel is that nicotinic receptor? The general case is a ligand-gated channel, right? And so you remember that the nervous system has ligand-gated channels only on dendrites in the cell body, right? Typically not along axons. They're separate in neurons. But in skeletal muscle, not only do you have ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, you also have voltage-gated channels. That's a totally different motif than in neurons. So that when the nicotinic channels depolarize, cause depolarization of the neuromuscular junction, what happens immediately at the same time? Because there are voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, what produces, or what do voltage-gated channels produce in a neuron? An action potential, right? But that doesn't happen until a signal gets to the axon hillock. But in a muscle, because there are voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, as soon as the sarcolemma depolarizes, an action potential starts right here. And what can you tell me about an action potential? How does it travel over an axon? Without decrement, right? Full force from beginning to end of the axon. The same thing for this muscle cell. You have an action potential that will flow over the whole muscle cell because you have voltage-gated channels everywhere on the sarcolemma of this skeletal muscle cell. So there is no place for integration. A muscle cell can't make up its mind not to contract. It always will because there are voltage-gated channels along with ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction. It will always cause an action potential that flows over the cell membrane. Okay, so what kind of synapse is the neuromuscular junction? Is it an electrical synapse or chemical synapse? It is still a chemical synapse because the information is transmitted across the cleft right here as a chemical signal, namely what? Acetylcholine. Okay. All right, so this thing right here, since it has special connections so that the axon terminal can't pull away from the muscle cell, and since it has both ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels, the structure is a lot different than a neuron synapse, we call it the motor end plate. All right, so here we see the motor end plate down here. It has different kinds of things than a regular synapse between two neurons. All right, probably in lab you talked about motor units. So think about those different kinds of channels right there in the neuromuscular junction. Right, and ask me maybe on Tuesday to go over that again. But that kind of describes why a muscle always contracts. It can't be really inhibited by innervation. All right, so a motor unit is the number of muscle fibers that are controlled by one motor neuron right here. And there can be a different number of muscle fibers that are controlled by one somatic motor neuron, right? So somatic just means on the surface of your body, and that's where you have skeletal muscle, the more superficial regions. You don't have skeletal muscle in deep inside body cavities. So motor unit includes one motor neuron and all the fibers, muscle fibers that it innervates. Right? And the number of motor neurons compared to muscle fibers is what we call the innervation ratio. And it can vary from 1 to 100 or 1 to 2,000. And this just shows the relative degree of fine control that you have over a certain part of your body. Like, for instance, postural muscles in your back. Do you need to have fine control over muscles in your back? Not much, because you don't do much with your back, right? You don't speak a language, you don't write or anything, right? You sit up straight or you kind of slump over. So what kind of innervation ratio would you have for your back where you do not need fine control? A very small innervation ratio right here, like 1 over 2,000 is a small number, okay? All right, but as that number gets bigger and bigger and bigger, like 1 to 100, this is where you have much finer control over parts of your body, like in your face and fingers and things like that, right? For facial expression and for sign language and things like that, or writing skills. And that also relates to something about muscles, and that is, what can you tell me about an action potential? What is one action potential like compared to any other action potential? What about the duration? It's the same. What about the amplitude? It's the same. So an action potential, right, we say has an all or none response. It will either happen or it will not happen. It's not graded in response, okay? The same thing is true for muscle contraction of a particular muscle fiber, all right? It exhibits an all or none response, because when an action potential reaches the neuromuscular junction, what's always going to happen? It's going to cause action potentials right underneath the neuromuscular junction. Those action potentials will sweep over the whole muscle cell, and that muscle cell will contract with 100% of its ability to contract, right? Or what? Or it won't if it doesn't receive a signal. Okay. But you all know from experience that when you contract, for instance, the biceps brachii, it doesn't contract always at 100% of its capability, right? The biceps brachii can contract weakly or it can contract strongly depending on what you perceive the need to be with your eyes and previous experience and things like that, okay? And so how is it that a muscle like the biceps brachii can contract in a graded fashion? It can produce strong contractions or weak contractions, but every fiber, right, will either perform an all or none response. One single muscle cell will contract 100% or not at all. Why is that? Okay, and that's because of this concept of recruitment. Because the biceps brachii has numerous motor units in there. And so if the biceps brachii, if what you look at is going to require a weak contraction, right, then only a few motor units will be stimulated, causing just a few muscle fibers within the biceps to contract. Maybe 5 muscle fibers. So if you have 5 muscle fibers in your biceps contracting out of millions, what's the contraction going to be? Really weak, okay? But if you perceive an object to be really heavy, right, and you then cause more motor units to become activated. So now instead of 5 fibers contracting, now you have 1,000 fibers contracting. What's the overall force of that biceps? It's going to be a little bit stronger. Now if you see something really, really heavy, right, and instead of 1,000 motor units, you have all the motor units becoming activated in the muscle, what's the contraction of the biceps? It's going to be maximal. It's going to be very, very strong. So when you're brain figures out how many motor units to contract to perform a proper contraction, we call that recruitment. So your brain can recruit more and more motor units to cause stronger and stronger contractions of a muscle, because motor units can be, more motor units can become activated. All right, so don't forget the sign-in sheet, and we're going to start with structure of a muscle fiber. So if you want to drag out your anatomy book and look this over one more time, but make sure you know what a muscle is made out of. Fascicles. And what are fascicles made out of? Fibers. And fibers are made out of myofibrils. And myofibrils are made out of myofilaments. And then you got to know how many kinds of myofilaments are there. So if you know that by next time for the disaster drill, that would be great. Okay.
I was thinking about the psychiatry chapter 12.
What's 12? Oh, okay. I just haven't memorized all the chapters.